welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the conflict hotspots that are popping up all over the world, including new escalations in the civil war in Yemen. And first, is Russia acting out of aggression or self-defense in its threats against Ukraine? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Russia's relationship with Ukraine is complicated. Ukrainian independence coming out of the collapse of the Soviet Union ended a 350-year history of Ukraine as a part of the Russian Empire and then the Soviet Union. From that period forward, the two nations have faced off in several cases, most notably the Russian annexation of Crimea in 2014 and Russia's ongoing support for separatists in eastern Ukraine in a largely frozen civil war at this point since that year. Now there are reports of a large Russian military buildup on the Ukrainian border. Western powers, notably NATO members, have confronted the Russians over this buildup. Is war or conflict likely? What are the Russian motivations? And how should NATO respond to potential escalation? We will discuss this ongoing crisis with Robert English, Associate Professor of International Relations, Slavic Languages and Literature and Environmental Studies, as well as the co-director of Central European Studies at the University of Southern California. He's the author of Russia and the Idea of the West. Rob, thanks for joining us. The first question is, why is there an ongoing military buildup on the border between Russia and Ukraine?
Here's where I'd like to stake my position most clearly at odds with the conventional position, the Washington consensus, if you will, because that viewpoint would have that Putin is simply implacably hostile, that he has somehow personally or institutionally never reconciled with Ukraine's independence and wants to take it back into some kind of reassembled Soviet Union, some kind of expanding sphere of influence. So he has real imperial designs, according to this interpretation. My view is different. Putin is operating towards Ukraine and has over the past decade, in his mind, defensively. That is, Ukraine can be independent all it wants, although there's great regret about the severing of historic ties and so many co-nationals, so many ethnic Russians living in Ukraine, there are complications. But it's only when Ukraine begins trying to join NATO and move the Western military alliance right up to Russia's most sensitive borders, when even short of joining NATO, it's engaging in more and more maneuvers and build up and practicing and purchasing or getting free, sometimes, arms from the West. In other words, sort of creeping or de facto becoming a member of the alliance, that Russia gets really apoplectic, really concerned. And I think that the annexation of Crimea in 2014 had not to do, again, with the first interpretation, right? Imperialist desire to reclaim Ukraine, bring it back under Russia's control. But it had to do with the very imminent prospect, the fear that Crimea would become part of NATO and that the military installations at Sevastopol, where the both Ukrainian and Russians base their Black Sea fleets, that Russia would be booted out and NATO would take over, right? What could be more ignominious than seeing your military rival, this big bloc, not only expand up to your borders, so to speak, but also do it taking advantage of a big base that you yourself built. So I think that was the main, the proximate cause, the trigger or the spark for 2014. And I think that what's been happening with Ukraine's increasing steady cooperation with NATO and NATO having more and more infrastructure deployments, joint exercises, helping build bases, both in land and in sea, right, at sea as well, are what triggered Putin to escalate now and say, no, this is my red line. You can't do this. I'm going to fight. I'm going to threaten to fight, at least.
Were there recent developments, because you seem to, you know, you suggested there that the cooperation between Ukraine and NATO had increased. I guess part of this is a question of the timing of this. Is this, has NATO made recent moves the last couple of years that indicated more interest in having Ukraine join the organization?
Yes, in a number of ways. I think I pointed indirectly to arms sales the steady provision of things like anti-tank weapons and small arms and range finding equipment. For their part, the British are helping build a naval base in the Black Sea, and more and more Ukrainian cooperation, right? So joint maneuvers and so forth. Until and when Ukraine does join NATO, it doesn't have that guarantee, that Article 5 protection that an attack on one is an attack on all. But shy of that, everything else looks to Moscow like it's becoming integrated. And most recently, I think what might have been the real trigger was that Ukraine has been building up its forces, has been, in Moscow's eyes, preparing potentially for an attempt on a lightning strike to retake Donetsk, those eastern regions. In other words, no more bargaining, no more Minsk process. We're just going to retake them. And it very recently, the Ukrainian side, again, from Russia's point of view, this is Russia's point of view. I'm not saying it's the only one. The Ukraine began using drones, right? They purchased some of the same Israeli and Turkish drones that were so effective in Libya, and then especially in the Azerbaijan-Armenia war. And they used just one incident, maybe there were others, but there was one particular incident where a Ukrainian drone strike took out a Russian or a separatist, Russian-supported artillery position on the ethnic Russian side of the line of control, killed some soldiers. And that to Moscow was an escalation, a new weapon being deployed. So we don't know, right? I don't know what goes on in Putin's mind, but I see a large pattern that's consistent with the story I'm telling. And that would explain in part, at least, why the British building a naval base, the U.S. selling more arms, Ukrainian troops participating in more NATO exercises. And now the Ukrainians practicing with these deadly, these scary new weapons on the battlefield. You know, it doesn't mean that Russia doesn't have the preponderance of power, that Russia isn't threatening, right, with tens and tens, 100,000 or more troops. But from Moscow's somewhat paranoid point of view, they're afraid Ukraine, with Western support, was preparing to strike first. And it sort of resembles, in their mind, what happened in Georgia in 2008, when the Georgian government tried a lightning strike to reclaim a separatist territory, right? The South Ossetian territory.
I think one of the great ironies out of all of this, though, is looking back at 2014, whether or not Ukraine was more Central European oriented or Western oriented, NATO oriented versus Russian oriented, definitely was, you know, it was a matter of contention. I think Ukrainians were far from unified, but most of the research I've seen suggests that that's an issue Ukrainians are becoming increasingly unified on, a desire to that Ukraine have stronger relations with NATO or even join NATO. So is this sense of insecurity on the part of the Russians, if that's what's driving this, kind of of their own making because of the annexation of Crimea?
Since the annexation of Crimea, you're absolutely right. What Russia has done has turned many Ukrainians who were pro-Russian or had soft feelings toward Russia, or even though they were strongly Ukrainian pro-independence, also didn't want to be drawn into the alliance, the bloc competition, into the West's arms, so to speak. So yeah, since 2014. But again, Putin seems to have decided that it didn't matter if half of Ukraine didn't want to join NATO and half did. The government was pulling in that direction anyway, right? So to him, the answer to your question is, so what? I don't care about public opinion. I care about, is NATO expanding and taking in Ukraine? And I could see that in 2014, it was. So I didn't mess around anymore. In other words, he said, I'm not going to fight this out in the court of public opinion, because no matter what most Ukrainians think, you NATO allies, you NATO Americans seem determined to bring Ukraine in. And there's precedent for that. You know, we just brought in the last couple of years, two new countries have joined. One was North Macedonia. And the year before that, it was Montenegro. And Montenegro, even today after joining, but especially back in 2017, when it occurred, only about a third of the population was in favor. There was no referendum. NATO doesn't care about referendums anymore. Once upon a time, right, when a country joined or joined the European Union, they would have to hold a referendum and show that a majority of the public were in favor. Now, when a majority of the public is opposed, it doesn't matter as long as the political elite, the ruling party, is in favor. And I think Putin has become very cynical about this issue of supposed democracy when he saw what happened in the Balkans. So again, that's the answer to your question. You're right. But he's not playing that game anymore. He's just using force, threats, and the power game.
So with so many forces now on the border, the question I get asked most frequently is Russia going to invade? Is this a case of military pressure to try to compel NATO? I know one of the demands the Russians have made is that Ukraine will never become a part of NATO. And it seems like that's off the table, even though most analysts don't think it was going to happen anytime soon. The kind of the permanent statement, Ukraine is never joining NATO, seems to be off the table on the part of what's going on in Washington. But is this a real threat of an invasion, or is this just a bit of military intimidation?
It's a lot of military intimidation. But yes, I get your point. I don't think, in sync with what I said at the beginning, Russia wants to invade, feels like it needs to like occupy the whole country or vast swaths of it. This is largely saber rattling, threatening to get its concerns put on the table. And in some ways, it's succeeding, right? Because we're now debating, and especially the Europeans are debating, whoa, maybe we've gone too far too fast. If the Russians are this apoplectic about it, maybe they got a point. And what many behind the scenes are scratching their head at is just what you alluded to. Ukraine is not going to join NATO anytime in the foreseeable future. And we're talking 10, 15, maybe more years, because it simply isn't remotely qualified. And most of the key European allies never wanted it anyway. It was always an American project. Back at the 2008 Bucharest summit, the George Bush administration insisted on Georgia and Ukraine joining. The French and British especially said, no, 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 that's provocative. It's unnecessary. It's going to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so they put off Ukraine joining, but they had this bland statement that someday Ukraine and Georgia will join, but not now. They haven't changed their position. And NATO only operates by consensus. All it takes is one country that wants to block Ukraine, and Ukraine's not joining. So could the U.S. cajole, persuade, somehow get its allies, all of them, to go along, all the NATO member countries, and admit Ukraine, even though they're not wild about the idea, because we think it's so important? Well, I think the America that could do that was 20 years ago. But after so many problems and 4 years of Donald Trump and the erosion of trust between Europe and the U.S., none of that's Biden's fault. At least most of it isn't. I think the Iraq war is a big part of that. Right? The Europeans are still paying the price in the form of refugees and terrorist attacks coming from North Africa, coming from the Middle East, of our disastrous wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and to some extent, Syria. So the extent that Biden, the Obama administration were guilty too, they sometimes look and say, you know, when we follow your lead, look what you drag us into. So it may be that the U.S. cannot persuade the allies to let Ukraine in. I don't think they can. Ukraine isn't ready. So that raises the question, why would the Russians stake their flag on this? And my hope is that they're going to retreat, that this is their maximum bargaining position, just as we have our maximum. And right now there's no movement on either side, but that we'll find some creeping, especially if the Europeans, if the French and Germans, right, are launching separate talks with the Russians. We'll see proposals coming from them that say, well, what about this? We can agree that we're not going to dismantle NATO, Moscow, no matter how much you want that, forget it. But we can agree that in the eastern regions of these countries, there will never be any nuclear weapons or nuclear-capable deployments. No nuclear-capable aircraft from NATO will land at those airfields. And we will not deploy any INF or other sort of dual-purpose nuclear conventional weapons in the east. They could easily come up with a formula to keep NATO intact, to have the, let's say, infrastructure there in a crisis, should Russia decide to go crazy and attack. But in the meantime, not engage in those more concerning deployments. And there's the framework for compromise that Putin could accept and back down on his other demands. I'm hoping, you know me, I'm an incorrigible optimist, but I see a crack in this door that we could go through. But it's going to take some amazing diplomacy like we haven't seen since the Cuban Missile Crisis. This is really, really dangerous. A spark could set off a conflagration that nobody wants.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the ongoing Russian military buildup on the Ukrainian border and the crisis with Robert English at the University of Southern California. One thing that Putin has definitely accomplished through all of this, and the inspiration of this was a conversation I just heard with Richard Haass, that maybe one of the most important things the Biden administration did was take military intervention off the table early in these negotiations, that the U.S. has had a tendency, particularly in this region, to begin with the bluster, like, you know, we're not going to take this off the table, although I think we would both agree, the idea of U.S. forces in Ukraine against Russian forces, it's an incredulous, you know, threat at this point. But doesn't that reinforce the notion about Ukraine not joining NATO? Because if they were in NATO, there'd be no doubt that the U.S. would have to put a military option on the table. So I guess the question is this is, I'm speculating that maybe one of Putin's motivations here is to demonstrate to NATO, you don't want Ukraine anyway, because if you're not prepared to defend them, why would they be in NATO?
That is an element in his thinking. In other words, to force that understanding out into the open, where it lurks in the background in the minds of some experts. And the general public just has sort of these platitudes and, you know, sort of unilateral positions that don't yield. But in fact, as you say, if we're not willing to risk our lives or European lives, especially, much less American ones, to fight for Ukraine or to fight for the Donbass or whatever it is, even some limited conflict now, then why would we when it joins, if and when it joins NATO? This is such a game on so many levels. I think that Haas's observation initially about taking intervention off the table was an important signal to Moscow. And by the way, the deployment's underway. I decided to do a little digging in the last couple of days because we're reading about all these deployments to the Black Sea or the Baltic region and so forth. Yeah, so the Dutch are sending one frigate into the Baltic Sea where they hang out half the time anyway. And they're sending, I think, four fighter jets to the Bulgarian Air Force. They're loaning them. And meanwhile, the Dutch are sending a couple of their fighter jets to Lithuania. Look, that is so symbolically meaningless. I mean, it's not even symbolically meaningful, right? The Bulgarian Air Force, you might be interested to know, consists of leftover MiG-29s and Sukhoi 25, Soviet era aircraft that aren't even interoperable with NATO. They have a schedule to buy some F-16s, which are our cast-off weapons, maybe by 2027. Now they're going to have a couple of F-35 stealth fighters. You know that no one's handing them to the Bulgarians. So what are we talking about? We're talking about a couple of Dutch aircraft visiting an airfield. Purely symbolic. There's no way that could operate with a Bulgarian defensive force against Russia, even if somehow Bulgaria got drawn in. So it is theater. The same with Lithuania and the rest. I mean, what do those have to do in any case with defending Ukraine? They are a symbolic, well, if Russia should decide to gobble all of Eastern Europe, come on. So I think that the fact that these are pinprick, tiny, symbolic deployments tells us something as well, in line with what Haas was saying, that Biden administration is standing firm rhetorically and on certain principles they won't yield, at least not until Russia yields and we have a compromise. But they don't want real deployments, a real tinderbox to spin out of control. I like that observation. And don't forget, Biden, unlike Putin, has to deal with enemies behind him as well as in front of him. He has to deal with Russia. He has to deal with disunited European allies. And he has to deal with Republicans who are freely shooting him in the back right now. The Republicans who didn't seem to care much about Russia when their president was giving away the store are suddenly Russia hawks. He's got the hardest job of all, keeping all these constituencies on board.
Now, with that as the transition, then, if you were advising President Biden or Secretary Blinken, at one level, there could be definitely American concessions, like, you know, whether it's saying Ukraine will never join NATO, or at least a time frame to say, well, you know, we'll make a guarantee that not in the next 20 years or something along those lines. I guess one of the challenges, though, is the Americans don't want to signal to the Russians that military bluster, that you can get away with bullying. So if you were advising the Biden administration, what would be some of the general principles that you would suggest?
Well, it's difficult. I mean, Biden is juggling the real military confrontation with the theater of alliance politics and then the domestic politics as well, fairly well, as best he could. And he's been savagely attacked for a couple of, you know, misstatements, which are in fact matters of fact. He just said what everyone already knows, and it's no secret to Putin that the allies are divided on this. So that wasn't letting a secret out that weakens us. It's something everyone already knows. I would say what Biden would need to do, his diplomats will have to work, whether it's Blinken, whether it's Wendy Sherman, it's probably lower at the working level with Russian foreign ministry and with, again, our NATO allies who might be the ones in separate talks who find where the compromise will lie. As I said, on limiting deployments of NATO in Eastern Europe or a formula for delaying a decision on Ukraine for at least a decade. And then Biden can say, first of all, I'm doing this with our allies. this is what our NATO allies want. So he doesn't have to lead and take most of the flak for it. And secondly, it appears strong enough. He emphasizes we are not yielding on our principle that we do not let Russia decide who's in our alliance, when in fact, Russia's opposition, if it's powerful enough, even if Washington doesn't want to admit it, the Europeans say that has to be a factor. So yes, in a way, Doug, it's saying bluster or threats are rewarded. But, you know, sometimes we are realists. You know, I know you and I are both liberals and constructivists at heart. We are idealists in our aspirations for global politics. But sometimes we're rudely reminded that it's a realist world in some essentials after all. And the Russian response is, you darn right it is. And while you were busy patting yourselves on the back with your liberal internationalism and your promoting democracy and your, you know, regime change all around, we watched something very different. We saw an endless expansion of American power. We saw some just disastrous interventions that have inflamed Europe, that have had boomerang effects, backlash against us Russians too, in Chechnya, in our volatile Muslim regions. And what's more, we saw this NATO juggernaut just keep going beyond the point it made any sense. Why does Montenegro have to be in NATO? Why is North Macedonia? Is there literally simply a mandate that everyone gets to join, even if they're unstable little countries that contribute nothing, and that even, again, trample over democracy when two-thirds of Montenegrins say, we don't want this. We're allies of the Serbs. We're traditionally close to the Russians. We're Orthodox Christians. But one corrupt ruling party decided to do it. So the Russians say, you know, knock it off with your democracy, your liberal ideals. You are playing power politics too. We're just finally pushing back a little bit. Mm-hmm. That's how Moscow sees it. I'm not saying every bit of that is true. It's a little overly cynical, but our version, I think, in our media is a little overly idealistic. And, you know, somewhere in the middle lies something a little more, you know, honest. And in that middle lies a compromise that, again, we sugarcoat. So neither side looks like it's backing down utterly, but allows both sides to de-escalate this crisis. Russia doesn't want to invade and occupy Ukraine. That'll be the end of Putin's regime and a catastrophe for Russia. It will be unpopular, deeply unpopular in Russia. It will be deeply expensive. It'll be crippling economically. Putin doesn't want to do that. He wants to pressure and get some concessions to Russian security, and he's doing it in this scary, threatening way.
Last question, since you mentioned about it being crippling economically, what seems to be the most common American response, NATO response on the table, especially since the military response is not on the table, are economic sanctions. If this, in fact, escalates, and definitely if Russia invades, or even if there's something short of that, it seems fairly likely that the response would be some form of economic sanctions. They really haven't been successful in getting Russia to withdraw from Crimea, although maybe that was too large of an ask. How much of the threat of economic sanctions at this point serving as a deterrent for Russian military operations?
I think it's pretty significant because the nuclear sanctions have not been applied yet, right? So this is ejecting Russia from the SWIFT fish of the global SWIFT payment system and the global financial system. That would really hurt. And that would also sort of isolate Russia long-term from foreign investment, from trade. It would be really devastating and would drive Russia kind of into a permanent reliance on and dependence on China, which they do not want. We don't want that either, frankly. The Europeans, for their part, you know, where are they going to get their energy, right? If Nord Stream 2 is blocked, and in fact, they other purchases of Russian gas are halted, where are the Europeans going to get their energy? Their energy prices are going to skyrocket. They're going to turn on the coal and nuclear plants again and take a gigantic step backwards environmentally. They're going to buy American LNG. Can't do that. American LNG is all privately owned and it's all going to Asia where the price is higher. It's just a disaster for Europe economically. So you've got a point when you emphasize that Russia has that gas, that economic leverage. Look at the sanctions so far, right? On technology investments, on agricultural products. Where did Europe or the U.S. sanction the import of Russian natural gas? Nowhere, right? So our European allies don't want that either. It really is an open question. Who would be hurt more? Of course, Russia objectively would be hurt more, but Russia can take more pain being a dictatorship. It's not clear what it would do to these European countries struggling to come out of COVID, struggling to come out of recession, to now find that everyone's going to pay 15% more for their heating bills and for their energy. You're going to see a lot of liberal social democratic governments out in 2 minutes and you're going to see Marine Le Pen and, you know, Salvini and all the kind of Russia-loving right-wingers in Europe elected before you can say Jack Robinson. And I think Blinken and Biden know that, too. We are so interdependent, and we are dependent on our allies to try to act in concert. It's a lot easier to do Russia diplomacy than Western.
So it's a reminder, I guess, a couple of the messages taken from this is, first of all, this is somewhat a bet that the U.S. made and needs to lie in it with respect to its the breaks with some of the Europeans, in particular, some of the U.S. adventurism in the last 20 years or so. But also, seemingly with all of this, it's a reminder that the Russians still have quite a bit of leverage, particularly in their own neighborhood, and that the U.S.'s relative disregard for Russian security interests is driving this crisis, at least in part, but capitulation isn't really an option for the U.S. at this point, because certainly the message there.
I think it looks like capitulation. The devil will lie in the details of finding a way both sides can back down a little bit and open the door to compromise a crack without it appearing to be capitulation. And of course, Biden will be attacked as having capitulated no matter what, but he's already being attacked for that anyway. But if the compromise can appear to come from the French and Germans, and nothing that Emmanuel Macron would like better. Of course, now we have a German-French competition to be the diplomatic leader of Europe, because Olaf Scholz has even used the term Ostpolitik, you know, hearkening back to the days of Willy Brandt. So both of them would like to be, as leaders who are trying to burnish foreign policy credentials, would like to be the ones that sort of broker a compromise. And that will be fine with Biden. Let them take the heat. It'll die down. He's got problems in the midterms anyway.
Yeah, it was a reminder when that was a strategy Obama used to some success. It was criticized from leading from behind, but it seems like a bit of leading from behind at this point probably is likely on the table.
That's well put.
Very good. Well, let's hope that this continues to be a diplomatic crisis and avoids a military crisis. And let's hope that the leadership of all these countries find some sort of a compromise that can get us out of what would be quite devastating if this does erupt into a military
crisis. Hear, hear. Well said.
We have been discussing the ongoing military and diplomatic crisis between Russia and Ukraine and Russia and NATO over Ukraine. Our guest today has been Robert English, Associate Professor of International Relations, Slavic Languages and Literature and Environmental Studies, as well as co-director of Central European Studies at the University of Southern California. He's the author of Russia and the Idea of the West. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you very much, Doug.
When we come back, an ongoing and escalating crisis in Yemen. Stay with us. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The Houthis in Yemen have launched drone strikes against the United Arab Emirates. Is this a new round of escalation in that ongoing and devastating war? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. The ongoing civil war in Yemen risks an escalation with drone strikes launched by the Houthi against the United Arab Emirates. This is apparently in retaliation against the increased military campaign against the Houthis led by the Saudis and the UAE. The Houthis themselves, a group in control of Yemen's capital, but unrecognized by most of the international community. Our panel will explore the Houthi motivations for this strike, the impact on the ongoing and devastating Yemeni war, and regional security broadly. We're joined today by Hamoud Salih, Professor of Political Science and Associate Dean of International Education at California State University, Dominguez Hills. He's a frequent commentator for Arab media and also for our show. Charles Schmitz is professor of geography at Towson University in Baltimore, Maryland. He's also an affiliated scholar with the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. He is the author of Houthi Visions of the State, a Houthi Republic with an Unofficial Imam and a Parasitic Political Economy. Thank you both for joining us. And in many ways, this is a bit of a, you know, of a checking in on a war that frequently, it continues, but frequently is not featured in the American press. So, Charles Schmitz, I'll ask you first. The Yemeni war involves this group, the Houthis, backed by Iran, who controls the capital, and a coalition led by Saudi Arabia and UAE fighting against the Houthis in kind of an ongoing strike that broadly doesn't seem to have changed much in years. Has anything changed in the last, say, 9 months or so since we last had you on?
Doug, that's a great question. Though it may appear that it's just constant fighting, there actually have been some important developments. So let me run through them to get us up to speed. In 2018, a group called the Amalika, the Giants Brigade, which is made up largely of Salafi from all parts of the country and are backed by the Emirates, they made their way up the coast, the Red Sea coast, and they approached Hodeidah. And at that point, the international community started making a lot of noise, saying that an assault on Hodeidah, which is the main port for North Yemen, would cause a crisis, that it would cause a humanitarian crisis, the fighting in the urban areas and whatnot. And eventually, the Amalika Brigade stopped, and there was an agreement made that basically neutralized that front. And following that, the Emirates pulled back from the war in Yemen. They announced they were withdrawing troops because they felt that this was going to be a stalemate, that the military because of the pressure from the international community, there was no real chance of making progress militarily. And they also appeared to be making an opening to Iran. The Emirates have a lot of relations with Iran, financial, economic relations with Iran, and they seem to be opening channels with the Iranians and backing away from the war in Yemen. And then when Biden was elected, of course, Trump had put the Houthi on the terrorist list. In the last minute of his administration, he put the Houthi on the terrorist list. And Biden took them off. And the Biden administration seemed to think that if they went after the war on a diplomatic front, they could, and they showed some good intentions, that they could bring the Houthi to the table and they could resolve the conflict diplomatically. But the Houthi read that quite differently. The Houthi read that as either that there was a coming negotiation and they wanted to move the military front as far as possible before the settlement happened, or they read it as a sign of weakness and they pushed hard, and they pushed hard on the front in Mareb, where they threw tremendous resources. Many, many Yemenis lost their lives as the Houthi pushed towards Mareb. And Mareb is significant because Mareb is in the north of Yemen. It's the stronghold of the northern Yemeni military that opposes the Houthi. And it's also the place where there are significant oil and, well, there are important, let's put it that way. They're not very big, but on the larger scale, but there are important oil and gas resources that were there, and the Houthi were trying to take it. In the defense of Mareb, the Saudi Air Force was critical. The Saudi Air Force, because the Houthi had come out of the mountains and were coming across open ground, and it left them open to attacks from the air. And so in the defense of Marib, the Saudi Air Force was critical. And I think the Americans sort of came around to see, well, wait a minute, you know, the Houthi are trying to solve this militarily. They have no interest in coming to the diplomatic table, and they won't until they have been stopped. And so the Biden administration said they were going to cut off offensive weapons to the Saudis. Eventually they said, well, we'll give them only defensive ones and whatnot. But they actually resupplied them with weapons that they could use in Marib, in the defense of Marib. The Saudis had limited their attacks to that immediate front for a long time. And the Houthi got very, very close. I mean, within kilometers of the main city of Marib. And then suddenly they took parts of the south in Shabwa, in Beihan in the north. They took three provinces up there. And at that point, there seemed to be a shift. And this is the significant shift. All of a sudden, the Amanaka brigades, which had been sitting up in a Hodeidah doing nothing because of the agreement, pulled back and allowed the Houthi to take significant territory. And they redeployed in Shabwa. And they immediately took those three administrative areas, those three counties, we can say, of Beihan in the north, and put the Houthi on the defensive. And the Houthi have been pushed back. The war, the dynamics of the war have shifted. And now the Yemeni government has the initiative and the Houthi are losing significantly. That's the context in which those attacks on the Emirates took place. They are warning against the Emirates who have re-engaged the war to say, don't do that, trying to force the Emirates to get out, to make the Emirates pay for re-engaging the war in Yemen, because it's effective, because the Houthi are on their heels at this point, where it looked like they were going to take Marib and make a significant sort of conclusion to this war. Now they're being pushed back, and it's not clear where the pushing back is going to stop. There is a significant forward motion of the Yemeni. So that's the context in which we understand these new developments.
So Hamid Salmi, the description here then is that the Houthi attack was really driven by their own growing military weakness as a way to try to compel UAE to not engage. I guess the first question is it likely to succeed, or is UAE's response likely going to be to continue, you know, to engage, continue to, you know, to pressure the Houthis?
It's a very, very difficult answer. And I think I'm repeating President Biden's answer, that when he talks about the conflict as a difficult solution. What's happening in the region since the UAE first began withdrawal from the conflict in Yemen, and then the fear that Marib will be under the control of the Houthis takeover of the Marib, the coalition between the Saudi and the United Arab Emirates apparently led to the Houthis' reaction. But there are a lot of things behind the scene. There is one, the strategic initiatives that are happening. On the one hand, you've seen since January 2021, I believe, when the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council, came in and said, well, let's reach out to the Turkish. And you have a vast sort of a huge movement now with Turkey reaching out to Saudi Arabia, reaching out to the United Arab Emirates, and establishing, and even the latest proposal just weeks ago, is to have trade that will save the Turkish-UAE relation, trade relation time if they go through Iran. So you have this sort of a group or a set of a bloc that is composing there, where the Turkey is now reaching out to the Gulf countries and being part of it. And then they even have reached out to the Israelis, and they have done all of this, but for the first time publicly, Erdogan comes in and say, we are going to take the Israeli partnership as a serious partner, and we will do whatever we can to improve our economic conditions, specifically they are looking at the trade as a way to save their economy. So there is that block that is happening. What's very interesting there You have Israel, whose interest is part of the equation. You have the UAE and Iran on one side. And then you have Iran's involvement in Yemen. How much of those economic interests will be damaged by a continued attack of the Ansar group or the Houthis inside the United Arab Emirates? And also inside, it could be Saudi Arabia. They have done that, but there is no reason for them to could do. So there is that factor. And then next to it, there is, one should not ignore that there is in the regional level, the Arab subsystem level, you have the Algerian initiative, which is pushing to organize an Arab League meeting or summit meeting that will address seriously the issues of the regions and including Yemen. Now, Israel, and also they are strong in favor of the Palestinians, they want the Arab to form that bloc. So Israel now is also interested in engaging inside Yemen, and particularly reports now said that the Emiratis have reached out to the Israelis to get intelligence, weapon, to preempt any strikes against them. So how likely the Houthis will respond is also linked to the Vienna negotiation or the Iranian negotiation. I think that's the main thing. If we are reaching to a solution, there are discussions today and this week, but there is a possible discussion, some kind of an agreement. I think that's where the Houthis are sort of looking for obvious reason. They are being supported by the Iranians, and they are being played or in a way to tack into the strategic depth of the Iranians on the one hand, helping them be stronger and also weaken their partners. So it's a very, very difficult questions. And to point it out finally, that even President Biden, when asked just recently, is it time for the United States now to consider the Houthis or the Ansar as a terrorist organization, he said it's under consideration and all parties should come to discuss the conflict, which means it is no longer just about one party. He's also expecting the Houthis to do something. He's expecting sort of that all the Yemenis come together. So to answer your question, Douglas, and I know I went along, just basically tell you that I have no answer, but it does look like it's going to be further escalation. The determining factor is how the nuclear negotiation will go. If those goes well for the Iranians, maybe it's a way for them to put a brake on the Houthis to stop doing this.
When you listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, we are discussing the ongoing civil war in Yemen with Hamoud Salih of California State University Dominguez Hills and Charles Schmitz of Towson University. So Charles, Hamoud raised the issue about these levels of complexity. There's actually two really interesting points here. One that I would like to first explore is this role of Iran, because the U.S. is now diplomatically engaged in Iran, perhaps still early stages, but is Yemen likely going to have an influence, is going to be influenced, I should say, by U.S. negotiations with Iran and the nuclear deal? Because I would imagine the Houthis have to recognize there's a possibility that the level of support they're getting from Iran would be weakened as a potential concession. Or is that unlikely, you know, to play much of a role in the calculations in the war?
No, I think it is. It's complex. There's a lot of unknowns. But the technology that the Houthi have, the capability of hitting the Emirates is Iranian. That clearly came from Iran. And if Iran didn't want that to happen, it would not happen. So there is the Iranian role there. There is a degree in which the Houthi and the Iranians, their interests don't coincide. The Iranians, of course, they love being able to harass the Saudis. It has advanced their position vis-a-vis the GCC, which they love. Of course, they're in a good position. But the Houthi are interested in ruling Yemen, stabilizing Yemen and ruling it. They want to be the rulers of Yemen. There was news of a very prominent Houthi Salah Hibra, who came out and said that the directives of the Iranian ambassador, that Iran had an Iranian ambassador who died recently in Yemen. And he said that the Iranian ambassador's directives hurt the Houthi. And I think he was referring to the offensive on Marib, that it cost too much. It was too costly, that they shouldn't have done that. And there, I think he's speaking to, you know, some many Yemeni who would be supporting the Houthi, part of the Houthi organization, chafe a little bit at the idea that Iran is directing the leadership, that Iran is calling the shots. And so there is a little bit of difference. Thus far, it's the same. I mean, the attacks on the Emirates showed that the Houthi have capability of hitting the Emirates and of hitting Saudi Arabia, which they didn't have before. There were none of these attacks before the coalition offensive on Sana'a, on the Houthi. So the Houthi, I think this was also inter-Houthi politic to a certain degree. So far, the forward position, the military aggressive position, which has coincided with the Iranians, has been forward. But, you know, there are other coalitions that say, okay, you know, it's time to negotiate. We're in a strong position. And so that's a question also of, you know, what's going to happen within the Houthi leadership.
And so, kind of similar question, Hamoud, certainly could talk about the role that Iran is playing, but you had highlighted the role that Israel is playing here. So immediately what comes to mind is this, you know, how much is UAE motivated by these new openings that came from the previous administration, the so-called Abraham Accords, that seem to, you know, suggest that there's at least some motivation. The Israelis have some lever of influence over UAE. And secondly, just, I guess, broadly, this question about, you know, Iran's influence and the new U.S. diplomatic engagement in Iran in, you know, what appears to be at least some initial conversations about the Iran nuclear deal and whether or not is Yemen going to be a part of, you know, that deal. Are the Houthis, where they're going to be sold out by the Iranians in order to get that deal?
It's very, very complex. So, and there are several parts of it, and they are all connected. The linkages that you've seen just in recent days are puzzling. And the key issue, whether these countries are, I'm speaking of Saudi Arabia, Iran, United Arab Emirates, that are all involved in this Yemeni conflict, how much this relationship they are building will have an effect on how they address the Yemeni question, or whether can the Yemeni question be the area in which they all agree to put it as an on status quo, that, you know, we are going to have problems there, not deal with it. But you've seen just recently an opening between the Saudi Arabia and the Iranians, where they open supposedly, was it offices for the Organization of the Islamic Conference in Riyadh. And then both ministers of foreign affairs came out and said, you know, we are both ready to open the embassies. And then you have the Saudi foreign minister come in and say, we'd love to have a relationship with Iran, except they have to take the Arab concerns. To which the Iranian respond, well, you know, we welcome you to join the Hormuz Treaty, the Hormuz Agreement, an old agreement which basically says, you know, the Gulf should be free of all intervention, non-nuclear weapons, all of that. So you have this dialogue that is happening on this level. And then the biggest one of them, when you look at trades and you see the amount of trade that has been going on between the Emiratis. I mean, if you live in Dubai, you'll see Iranian, you wouldn't think that there is actually a problem between Iran. These are serious interactions that are happening in that region. The biggest fear, I think, for changing all of that is, number one, what he mentioned, and Charles mentioned very, very correctly, the idea of this negotiation, the nuclear negotiation, where is it going to go? How Iran will respond to that? And are we going to get what the Iranian wants to get? But the other thing is this escalation, what Charles talked about, the military people who are behind, or the militaries who are behind attacking the United Arab Emirates, can they sustain those attacks? And particularly with this economic interest that the Iranians have, and Iranians need an economic outcut. And it turns out that the Chinese project, the Chinese plan that they have may not be enough, may not come soon. So there are this series of problems that may have impact. I think the bottom line is, again, the nuclear issue is dominant. Obama administration thought they could have a deal and leave the issue of original role of Iran and the ballistic missiles to a later stage. That position at this point has been sort of overlooked, or it seems to be part of a discussion, but not to the degree that Obama's going. I think a deal is needed, number one, for the Obama administration, because the Obama administration needs a win out of this, and particularly if the other front, the Ukrainian issue, fails.
Hamoud, you're saying the Obama administration. Do you mean the Biden administration?
The Biden administration.
Right, okay. I was getting a little confused there, yeah.
Yeah, the Biden, of course, yeah. The Biden administration needs a win, particularly if the other side is collapsing. You don't know, I mean, we don't know how much his polling will go down on the elections coming up, so he needs to show some kind of result. And that's where a compromise from the United States is possible for the sake of achieving some kind of result. I think a resolution of that conflict could happen on that front. The other thing is possible, maybe the United Nations envoy is able to get initiative going, get some assurances for the UAE that the UAE will go back to its 2019 proposal to withdraw, or initially began to withdraw, and put the status quo and sort of idle the Yemeni question on one side, or get it going in a political negotiation under the UN envoy, and the Iranian nuclear issue continues to be discussed or somewhere. What's really clear is that there are so interests that are so much linked, and the failure for having a dominant power to achieve what you may call a zero-sum game. The Houthis initially, you know, they were strong, and then the UAE and the Saudi Arabia come back and are winning now. As long as we are in that win-lose situation, and without a political leadership that comes and put a real agreement on the front, we are going to continue seeing this kind of a crisis that has a huge impact on other areas.
Now, Charles, we started off the conversation talking about diplomatic initiatives and the possibility of some sort of a negotiated settlement here, and the calculation on the part of the Houthis that if there's going to be some sort of a negotiation, let's improve our military as best as possible before we get to the table. Now that the Houthis, you know, have to reason that, I mean, their position is weakened and probably will continue to weaken. I think of this notion of mutually hurting stalemate, bringing groups, you know, to a table. Is this likely to motivate the Houthis to some sort of a negotiated settlement, or has it actually had the reverse effect, telling the Saudis, telling the government of Yemen, that why not continue these rounds of fighting? Because if we can continue to erode the Houthi position, maybe we don't need to negotiate. That's a broad way of asking, is there a negotiated settlement opening right now? And is it possible in the next, say, you know, 6 to 9 months?
I don't see it on the horizon. The Houthi have refused to see the new UN ambassador from Sweden, Grunberg. He's never made contact with them. Well, he's never, you know, gone to Sana'a. They don't acknowledge him. It's a good question. I don't know. Hamoud is right to wonder how sustainable the Yemeni government's offensive against the Houthi is. They're moving now, going forward. But, you know, if they get into the highlands again, I doubt they'd be able to sustain it. So it would be back to a stalemate. The Houthi really, they see themselves as the rulers of Yemen, and they see those that are fighting as mercenaries. They see those that are fighting them as mercenaries of the Saudis, Israelis, Americans, and Emiratis. So they don't recognize other Yemenis as political partners. Maybe it's propaganda, but I don't see the Houthi engaging in a political settlement that integrates the other parts of Yemen, the anti-Houthi parts of Yemen, into a state. So I at this point, I don't see this. I don't know. Yemen has surprised me many times, and many things I've foreseen have not happened and have been wrong. So, you know, I don't like to prognosticate. I don't like to go into the future because it's impossible to tell. But at this point, I do not see a negotiated settlement. I see fighting until maybe the movement on the lines has stopped at some point.
We have about 90 seconds left, so I'll ask you the same question. Mahmoud Salih, do you have any degree of optimism that there's a potential for negotiated settlement, or are we going to see more of the same?
Not for now, but what I'll be watching for is the upcoming, if it's held, Arab League summit in Algiers. The Algerians appear to be serious about having a constructive meeting. The Syrian return to the Arab League is one of the issues. The Yemeni issue is another one. The Algerian president has visited Egypt and had meeting with President Sisi. And there are some discussions there that could lead somewhere. Also, the Algerians are siding more and more on the Saudi side on several issues. They condemned the latest attack by the Houthis in Emirate. These are all good signs that possibly we could see something there. I don't know what it is, or at least an initiative in the Arabic style, the Arab style, where it's more of a public relation, diplomatic talk rather than substance. But there might be something there. But if you're asking me a direct question, as much as I am a hopeful person, I see pessimism more than anything else in the Yemeni conflict, at least until we do another show on this.
Actually, a perfect segue. I hope the next time we have you on and check in, we have a little bit more optimistic, a little bit more hopeful news. But in the meantime, it seems like the civil war in Yemen just continues dragging on, and a reminder, it's been utterly devastating to the Yemeni people and the need for a resolution to this conflict. We've been discussing the ongoing Yemeni civil war with Mahmoud Salih, professor of political science and associate dean of international education at California State University, Dominguez Hills. He is a frequent commentator for Arabic media and for us as well here at Scholar Circle. Charles Schmitz is professor of geography at Towson University in Baltimore, Maryland. He is an affiliated scholar with the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C., and he's the author of Houthi Visions of a State, a Houthi Republic with an Unofficial Imam and a Parasitic Political Economy. Thank you both very much.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.